Kia kaha and welcome to another podcast in the remarkable series People, Places and the Climate Crisis, a series where I have the privilege of interviewing 16 outstanding climate experts on climate and local government in the lead up to the local body elections in October. I'm Lindsay Wood from the Resilience Climate Trust, and we're running this series in conjunction with Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. At the end of the podcast, I'll give you details of the different ways you can listen. But now it's time for this interview with Professor Rafe Chapman from the Victoria University of Wellington on the theme Buildings, Transport and Urban Planning. So here's the conversation between Professor Rafe Chapman and me, which I do hope you enjoy. Our guest today is Professor Rafe Chapman, an economist who's worked in government, consulting, and academia. He helped negotiate the Kyoto Protocol for New Zealand and has since largely focused on cutting carbon emissions, such as mitigation policies in transport, energy, housing, and cities. Rafe recently retired from his post as longtime director of the Environmental Studies Program at Victoria University of Wellington, where he remains an adjunct professor. Rafe is also a co-director of the New Zealand Centre for Sustainable Cities. In 2021, as a member of Philippa Howden Chapman's research team, he shared in receiving the Rutherford Medal. In late 2015, his book about climate change policy, Time of Useful Consciousness, was published, and in 2014, a housing and health research team, of which he is a member, received the Prime Minister's Science Prize. A very big welcome to you, Rafe. Thank you for joining us and bringing your expertise to our series here. Lovely to have you on the show.
Well, it's very welcome. Good to be here.
Lovely. Well, let's start with when considering settlements and buildings and transport. It's very easy to gravitate towards the physicality of those elements and rather bypass that they are fundamentally about people and about how we live. Can you kindly start by giving listeners a broad picture of the sort of human outcomes that good urban form would be expected to achieve, and if possible, give current New Zealand urban planning a general scorecard in that regard?
Well, that's a big one to start with, but it's a good question. Cities are really interesting. Cities and urban form are really interesting phenomenon, and it's been said that cities are a manifestation of human civilization, one of the more sophisticated manifestations. They represent so much of our ingenuity and our ability to innovate and do things, get together and come up with new technologies, new ways of living, and so on. All that's very true, but in recent years, I think, and you have to put this in the perspective of, the fossil fuel revolution from 1800 or so. In recent decades, I should say, our cities have become very shaped by the use of fossil fuels. And the problem with that has been that we've become very energy profligate. And, we've used fossil fuels to expand our cities in an unconscionable way. It made sense when fossil fuel was cheap and we didn't think about the consequences. But now that we know that use of fossil fuels is highly problematic to nature, we have to rethink our cities. So good urban form is really something we've got to set in that context. And we now realize, I think, increasingly, we realize that we've got to rethink our urban form and move towards something that's more sustainable, actually not just in terms of fossil fuels, but in terms of pollution, in terms of, the sort of infrastructure we need and so on and so on, all of which in many ways comes down to being more sustainable, more respectful of nature, and certainly less fossil intensive. You asked also about giving New Zealand urban planning a general score in that regard. I would say, you know, we followed along rather blindly. We started our cities in New Zealand in the Victorian era, of course. I'm talking post-Maori settlement, but, you know, sure. With Europeans coming to New Zealand, you know, I should say that our Maori settlements were highly sustainable and very nature compatible. Mm. But with Europeans coming to New Zealand, they were pretty good urban form initially. But as, you know, with the advent of mass use of fossil fuels in the late 19th century, they've expanded and they were even pretty reasonable in terms of compact cities until about 1950. And then there was a revolution in urban form with the almost deliberate attempt to promote the car. And, if you go back to Chris Harris's work, historical work on cities, he points to a juncture where in the 40s, 1940s, there was a choice between planned cities and use of the railways out to places like Nainai and so on in Wellington and the Wellington region on the one hand, and then building of motorways on the other. And there was a campaign run in the late 40s really pointing to the choices that people had. And compact cities were characterized as socialist, and more spread out cities which promoted the use of cars and motorways were characterized as the new modern city. But this was very much an ideological choice that was put to people, and people didn't really see the implications in general. So there was a move very much as planners to endorsing that more spread out city, more spread out urban form. And that's so you can't really blame the planners in a way, because there were huge interests, property interests, development interests, motorway building interests, concrete sales interests, but really it was the car and the development of this sprawling city that got us into such a fix by the end of the 20th century, and has been, you know, something we need to reconsider now very rapidly.
Thank you. Well, I'm putting that back into a scorecard. I take that as a not a very good score, but one that you can understand how it came about, sort of thing.
Yes, and it was, you know, you have the score is probably not too bad for planners as a profession, who were more conscious of some of the implications, that planners are more conscious of the implications for infrastructure costs, for example. But, you know, a lot of the sprawling, the urban development and highway planning and so on was driven by commercial interests, particularly centered around the car. And they overwhelmed the planners, and political interests were involved, and they then became dominant. And those motorway, oil, concrete development interests, and that. It's, in a way, that's just a manifestation of the development of capitalism. You know, it was very post-war capitalism was very much focused around selling more cars, selling more oil, developing cities in a sprawling sort of way, and there was a lot of money to be made in land development and so on.
Sure.
So the alternative was very much on the back foot.
And in a way, a narrative like that starts and then people grow up with it, and that becomes almost the given narrative. People often don't think outside that sort of mode then, do they?
That's right. And what's more, they don't think outside the box, but they don't think about the history and how they got there. So when people like Robinson and Mayor Robinson and Auckland tried to propose something like light rail, he was essentially laughed out of court by the big development interests.
Go back to Liverpool, Robbie.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so people didn't understand what massive consequences followed from the development model they had adopted in going for the car-based development model.
Oh, that's fascinating, Rafe. Yeah. In a way, the one of the things about the car development, and it's not the only thing, is the emissions that go with it. And our built environment accounts directly for maybe 20% of New Zealand's greenhouse gases. I know there's a bit of conjecture around that, and it depends a bit how you measure it, but that seems to be a realistic figure. And that's before we even take account of the transport implications of how we develop our buildings. Additionally, settlements and buildings are relatively intractable to change, so they lock in their effects for a very long time. And that makes them what I've almost called party central when it comes to the importance of local government getting it right. Can you please give listeners a sense of how decisions around transport and urban form and buildings, how they influence each other and how long-term benefits might be enhanced at early decision-making stages in those processes?
Right. Again, a big question. Let me start with an example of how hard it is to turn the emissions ship around. You'll have noted the recent emission reductions plan.
Yes, sure.
It's devoting $2.9 billion to cutting emissions out to 2035. Yet in the next 4 years, which is the period of the first emissions budget, emissions are estimated to fall only from about 300 million to around 290 million. So that's not very much. It's a cut of about 4% and could be as little as 2% out to 2035. In the next 4 years. Reductions are likely to gather speed as we head past 2030, but I worry that to keep everyone happy, we're holding back on the pressure and redirecting the ship too slowly. And indeed, a lot of the government's language reassures people that they won't have to do too much. It talks about, you know, quote, supporting New Zealanders through this transition by taking pressure off individuals and providing them with choices. Well, you know, frankly, people like twin cab ute buyers and mums driving kids to school in big fossil cars and builders fitting gas connections in new houses need to be under lots more pressure to make more sustainable decisions and not conventional choices. For me, conventional and uncaring choices have got us into our current predicament. And given that we're in a climate emergency now, the neoliberal language of choices has become problematic. And decisions need to be less individualistic and more heavily influenced by what's sustainable and ethical. So what does that mean for the 2022 budget allocations? And I don't know. You may remember that there's $569 million to pilot and roll out a vehicle scrappage scheme for lower-income households, to replace their family vehicle with a lower emissions alternative if they choose to. Well, that money would be better spent if it went solely to e-bikes or public transport or car share scheme vouchers, which are all much lower emissions alternatives rather than encouraging people to buy another car. And because car production is itself quite carbon intensive, and widespread individual car use creates congestion and demands for road building and maintenance. So one benefit of directing that money to e-bikes, for example, would be to encourage people to live closer and more centrally.
Sure.
And places where e-bikes and buses could readily reach, rather than encourage relentlessly expanding urban form, as you see in places like Tauranga and Auckland, Richmond, classic expansion of Nelson. There's no sense in reinforcing updated sprawling urban form that we've inherited. And new building in inner suburban or city centre locations is a much more sustainable vision and much more or less costly than dysfunctional than congested outer suburban sprawl. And what I'm trying to say is that it's difficult to turn the ship around, and when we do, there's an intimate connection between transport and the shape of cities.
That shouldn't come as a surprise to people, but ultimately we have to take an element of ownership of that problem, don't we? And your comments about it, the latest ERP being a bit too soft on everybody, unhappily, I agree with you. It would be better if we had a sense of resolve about it, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, I think the government is trying to do something quite brave, spending $2.9 billion on it. But, it does require some hard choices which have to be directed from the centre. Mm. And it's not all a matter of choices by individuals in a market. That's not the way it really is. Yeah.
Well, that's largely what's got us to where we are, isn't it? Or not, maybe not largely, but certainly a major contributing factor.
That historically, our choices have been heavily influenced by government and markets in different ways, but it's never been a free market, the choice of transport and urban form. It's always been influenced by government. And more often than not, the choices have been subliminally pushed in one direction by development and oil interests.
Mm. And unfortunately, a lot of that hasn't stopped yet, even though we need it to stop, doesn't it, don't we?
Yeah, that's right. If you consider, go back to what I was saying about electric vehicles, the production of electric vehicles, it's carbon intensive in itself. Even though electric vehicles are considerably better than fossil vehicles, but it's not as though there's a massive industry pushing electric bikes, because there's so much less profit in electric bikes than in electric cars. We are subject to huge influence by car companies, and they're not going to give up their influence in advertising anytime soon.
No, and I think that the narrative at the moment tends to be around the, if you think 15 years ahead, we're all going to be driving, but we'll be driving EVs. And I A, can't see that, but B, I certainly hope it's not like that.
Absolutely, yes. It's too much of a continuation. I think you will see people with electric cars if they're, middle or upper income people. But if we all just simply transfer to electric cars, A, it'll take a long time, and so that we won't produce fossil emissions enough, quickly enough. But also it'll be wasteful, and it'll be a continuation essentially of a fossil-based economy, just a little bit more efficient.
That's a good point. And in a way, we've been talking about transport, and that's probably a good segue into my next question, Rafe. And that is that I've often thought there seems to be a chicken and egg problem that puts urban areas constantly in public transport catch-up mode. Ideally, we'd have good buses and trains, et cetera, running as areas develop, but that's a large investment ahead of when good patronage occurs, which in turn leads to increased need for subsidies and the like. And the alternative seems to be that people almost by default rely on their own transport, which then promotes the car-centric living that can be so problematic and which we've just been talking about. And then we can add into that it's very challenging to retrofit a viable public transport system onto a town that hasn't had one. So can you outline for our listeners the place of public transport in the quest for climate resilience? And please give would-be councillors a few tips as to how they might make good progress on that front. And as you know, there's been a debate raging in very recent weeks about how far should bus fares be subsidised, for example. And so I see those all dots that connect. Over to you. I'd love to hear your views on it.
Yeah. They're intimately connected. I agree that in the past, the assumption was that developers would build new suburbs and then individual house buyers would buy cars to make life possible in that suburb. And providing bus services was a reluctant afterthought and responsibility for councils, since it did not marry up to the commercialised vision of prosperous young couples buying a home and car on the edge of the expanding area. But that vision, that distortion, if you like, of the preferred city, was always in my view about selling new and larger houses and more cars and the rest of the wasteful consumption-oriented lifestyle of the suburb. And it downplayed the possibility of active or public transport or more recently shared transport. So it was always maximising suburbia for the well-off, and those without cars were written out of the narrative. And that's a significant part of the population. Don't forget disabled people and so on who can't drive cars. So those who had to take buses were losers. Yeah, you're taking loser cruises. We now see what some of the downsides of that vision are, from, you know, air pollution to congested highways, wasteful and unnecessary car use and damaging carbon emissions, and a neglect of alternative ways of living. So one vision which was written out but can now be seen as much more viable and sustainable is that of shared transport resources and, you know, of course, buses are a way of sharing a resource.
Yes, of course.
But there's also shared land. Imagine a land-saving apartment building. Yes, even shared cars. So when a resource is shared, it naturally serves a lot more people than a fully privatised and individualised resource. And from an economic point of view, less GDP is generated, but resources are used more efficiently. So, if you're promoting growth of GDP, it doesn't measure up. And if you're thinking about using efficient resources efficiently, sharing makes sense. And instead of council resources going into building extensive transport and water networks far into the expanding suburbs, those resources can also be saved and used for shared buses and, effective, convenient, and reliable public transport. So the way we shape our suburbs straight has a direct connection, straight line of sight to the way we operate our public transport, build and operate public transport.
Thank you. One of the things that I've teased around and I haven't found the answer to is whether there is a This is me going off to one side for a minute, Rafe. Whether there is a clear sweet spot in things like urban density, where you get to the point where you think, if we build at that density or if we intensify to that density, then we will have a public transport system that is more readily viable, or whether there is no such thing as that sort of sweet spot. Intuitively, I feel there should be, but I'm not at all sure it's that simple.
Well, it's certainly the case that as density rises, it becomes much more feasible to run a reliable, efficient, convenient bus system, a transport system. But there are diseconomies from excessive density, if you like, very high density. So,
sure.
You can run highly effective public transport, but there are aspects of city living that become less attractive when you get to very high densities.
And, I'm thinking of Singapore as you're talking.
Yeah, exactly. I've got a mental image of Hong Kong here,
right.
Which is even higher density. And sure, they can make those high density cities more attractive with green walls and to leave parks in them and so on. They're not too bad. They're livable, but people are crammed into very small spaces. And I think the density of occupation is very high and quite, you know, certainly what nothing New Zealanders would find acceptable. So that is a problem. But I think there's a lot further we can go in New Zealand in making cities more compact and higher density and still retain attractive quality of life. I'd go there.
Another angle of that seems to be the narrative that the Kiwi lifestyle doesn't suit this more dense, intensified living. And yet, I know from my own experience in Europe and from the number of people I've talked to who've been in Europe, and they're not at all onto the, we've got to have the traditional Kiwi lifestyle. They like the urban environment. They like the proximity of services and hopefully living without a car. What do you see as the process that help the ordinary Kiwi say, actually, this increased intensity isn't so bad after all? It's got the pluses as well as the minuses. Can you comment on that?
Sure. And I can, like a lot of Kiwis, I can comment from experience having lived in London, Melbourne, Rotterdam, Geneva.
Okay.
New York. So, you know, those cities have very attractive lifestyles, and you can always walk to the nearest park, pretty exactly, much always. Yeah, London, for example, has a lot of parks. Depends a little bit where you are. And many cities are dotted with parks. Melbourne is another good example. It is possible to have apartments that are not, you know, 50 square metres, but can be 100 or perhaps even more square metres, so that they're not too crowded. So a lot of those sort of factors affect lifestyle, apartment size, you know, where it is, location, and proximity to public transport makes a massive difference. And the speed and efficiency of that public transport depends very much on how the city is built and so on. So, yeah, I think if Kiwis who've travelled can bring back that understanding of alternative models of urban form and design back to New Zealand and implement those, we can help. That can help make the transition for New Zealand cities. My daughter who lives in New York City at the moment is certainly a good example of someone who enjoys in the city, needs to get out from time to time, get out of the city, but is able to go to local parks and enjoy the many other facilities that a city of some density and some size provides.
All makes good sense to me. And in a way, that ties into my next question. Many listeners will have heard of terms like the 20-minute city or transit-oriented development and yet be unclear quite what they refer to. Can you explain for us what they signify and why they're discussed? They're almost as though they're axiomatic principles in both good urban form and good climate responsiveness. And I'm going to put you in a magic mode here. If you had a magic policy wand, what key urban development strategies would you conjure up to help make our future development both people-friendly and climate-friendly? So you've now got the magician's hat on, Rafe.
Yeah, that 20-minute city notion is really just an old idea repackaged by a Parisian professor, Carlos Moreno, who actually coined the term 15-minute city in 2016, for the idea that daily urban living needs should be able to be met within a 15 or 20-minute journey by foot or by cycle from where you live. And it's a good idea. And that's really the operating principle of European cities. And cars might be used for those few trips where you have a specialised need, for example, visiting a specialty shop or an art gallery in a metropolitan area, or maybe you're setting out on an occasional longer leisure or business trip, so you might hire a car for that. I remember some friends of ours who lived in London. They got rid of their car and they just relied on going to the country by train occasionally. But for all their everyday needs, they were right in the centre of London, close to the centre, yeah. And Wellington, by the way, is a 20-minute city and tens of thousands of people live there. And in fact, that's true of Auckland too. The ones that aren't are places like Houston or Los Angeles, they're almost the opposite. So almost every trip seems to take an hour or more.
and that's in a car very often too.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And you asked about the transit-oriented development term and or TOD. It's worth remembering that transit is the American term for public transport.
Thank you.
Yes, principle of good urban form is that you can use public transport for most of your daily access needs. And the key idea of transit-oriented development is that nearby a public transport station or interchange is a great place to build housing, typically apartments or sometimes townhouses. And so those living near a station can meet their needs very locally, and they can jump on a train or a bus and go somewhat further, perhaps to work or perhaps for occasional trips to a hospital or something like that.
And presumably then the 15-minute or 20-minute a maxim would then apply for the time that it's okay to take to get to that public transport hub. So in other words, if you could if you could walk from in 16 minutes to your nearest railway station or whatever, then that also fits that concept. Am I in the right ballpark?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you might take 10 or 20 minutes to get down to the, you know, the hub, and you might live in a rather green sort of area with medium density. There's lots of parks and trees and so on, but you can get somewhere in 10 or 20 minutes and, you know, meet most of those needs, and then if you need to go somewhere more specialised, you jump on public transport, and it's quick and it's effective. Yeah.
Great. Wonderful. Thank you. The government has put in a recent intensification policy enabling three dwellings per site generally. I think they call it the 3x3, don't they? Three dwellings and three stories up. That prescriptive approach hasn't yet reached, as far as I know, the sort of regional towns like Nelson, where I am. But it's very much on the radar, just the same in our future development strategies. Are talking about intensification, even though they're not directly governed by that policy. Given that such intensified living is somewhat alien to the traditional Kiwi lifestyle, and we have touched on this a bit before, Rafe, but would you please elaborate on, for listeners, why it's seen as such an important strategy to increase intensification? And I'm thinking here in terms of a climate context especially.
Sure, yes. Well, essentially it does come back to whether you can live your daily life in a low or zero carbon way. And basically that comes back to transport. But there's also indirect effects there. So if you don't need to take a car, or you don't live on the far outskirts of a big city where there's, there has to be very extensive investment in water systems or various bits of infrastructure. Three waters I'm thinking about here. and getting the three waters out to the, to the hinterland of a city, the outskirts of a city, is very expensive and carbon intensive. So by going there, locating there, you're implicitly buying into a very carbon intensive sort of lifestyle. And there's all the capital cost, all the carbon that goes into the buildings and the steel and the, the concrete to get to the outskirts of the city, plus the operational carbon production. So, if we can reconfigure our cities such, they're 15 or 20 minute villages or little towns, and they're well connected to the centre of the CBD, for a lot of us, that's going to make a huge difference. And I should remind you that, we're talking about the vast bulk of the New Zealand population here. We're not, let's face it, that 86 or 7% of us live in towns and cities, towns of over 1,000 or cities. Yeah. The number of people who live in rural areas and small towns of under 1,000 is pretty small in New Zealand. It's about 14% of the population, so not much, 1 in 7. So most of us are living in big towns and cities, and where we live makes a huge difference in terms of our fossil production of carbon, emissions of fossil carbon.
Sure. Yep. That's a very good perspective, thank you, because I think it's very easy. We know there's a big rural area, but it's not full of people, is it?
Exactly,
That's great, thank you.
Just a thought about towns. Often people with electric bikes could get, from one end of Masterton or something to the other, or Hastings, one end to the other, with a 5 or 10 minute cycle. And on an e-bike, that's incredibly feasible. Whereas if you go to those towns right now, those small cities, they're very car dominated, and that really has to change.
Well, I think the Nelson Tasman area a little bit, and exactly the same debate goes on a little bit about taking an e-bike between Nelson and Richmond, and that's quite doable on that. But also, you may or may not know, because it's very hot off the press, that Richmond or Tasman, the whole of Tasman, has just adopted a walking and cycling and active transport policy that is really wonderful. It's sort of bringing down the speed limits, it's allocating cycle lanes and reducing the number of parks and things. So I'm very encouraged by that. And it applies in all their settlements. Yeah. It's not just Richmond, but it's in Murchison and Takaka and so on as well. So good luck to the TDC on that.
And I would add that, you know, not just good luck to TDC, but good luck to all those other provincial cities and towns where they've really taken the bull by the horns. And you know, for example, Hastings or New Plymouth, and they've done great things in, you know, creating a different sort of model for those communities with lots more biking facilities and walking facilities, good tracks, good, you know, bikeways between, say, Havelock North and Hastings, you know, the very dedicated paths and cycleways so that people feel safe and, you know, they can get around by bike and or walking in some cases. Yeah.
That feeling safe is a very big part of the equation, isn't it? I know there's a big debate in the Nelson area about that at the moment. Well, Rafe, all good things
makes
have
all
to
the
come.
Difference.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? That's why I personally don't cycle, because I can't do it without being on roads where I'm at risk of being knocked off the bike by cars, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
One of the really cool things about having a specialist like you on the show, and my regular listeners will know I love this, is that I can invite you to share with us what would be your own top take-home message in your field. And this is for listeners generally, but also bringing it back into the business of climate change and the coming local body elections. So if you had a thing that you really wanted to impinge on our brains, what would it be, please, Rafe?
Well, the first point I'd make, I guess, is that the biggest opportunity for New Zealanders to make a difference, everyday New Zealanders, I'm not talking about farmers, you know, a very small percentage of the population, but for everyday New Zealanders to make a difference is to change the way they get around. So transport just makes a huge difference, and there's really important opportunities in transport. So that's why I've worked a lot around the transport area, because you can... it's sometimes difficult to make the change to get it implemented, and you know, poor examples like the Island Bicycle Way have not helped. But it is something that New Zealanders can make an individual difference with, but they can also work with their councils to shift, you know, move the dial, and you know, really reduce emissions through changes in aspects of their lifestyle. So, you know, transport is crucial, and it represents all up, 20% of New Zealand's greenhouse gas emissions, 40% of our carbon, over 40% of our carbon emissions, and that's the bit we can really control.
Yeah. Well, that's wonderful, and it's a very specific one, and everybody can apply it to their own circumstances. Rafe, I'm going to have to let you go at this point. Thank you so much for joining us on this series. It's been fascinating. I think you've gathered I could keep grilling you for another hour, but I won't inflict that on you. Thank you for joining us on Climate Matters.
Thanks for the opportunity, and all the best, Lindsay. Cheers.
Cheers for that. Well, I never get over the feeling that it's such a privilege to be able to have a conversation with someone like Rafe Chapman, and to be able to enjoy his incredible breadth of knowledge and his deep-founded expertise as well. Now, I promised to give you listening options for the series People, Places and the Climate Crisis. You can listen to the full interview with each guest on their own podcast, and these are available on Spotify, on Apple, and on other main podcast platforms. And they can be linked from my firm's website, which is at resilience.co.nz. And there you'll be able to navigate easily to our podcast page. And that will give you the full schedule of these podcasts, plus background information, as well as links to the podcasts themselves. And we'll also give you a link to the Fresh FM podcasts of the radio shows, and even to the Fresh FM broadcasting frequencies if you want to listen live. Just bear in mind the Fresh FM interviews are condensed to about a half or a third of the full length which appears on the individual podcasts. And as always, I would like to give a big thanks to Kahu Sanson-Burnett, who does a fabulous job as the sound tech and on the podcasting of these different episodes. And of course, a big thanks to you, our listeners. Thank you so much for joining this important discussion. We have many more fascinating experts coming up on the series, and I hope we enjoy your company for them too. And next up, we have two guests on the theme of making our regional economy less vulnerable to climate. And the guests are Ali Boswick, who's the CEO of the Nelson Chamber of Commerce, and Rod Oram, who is a well-known business and climate commentator, who I expect is well-known to many of you. So on that note, this is Lindsay Wood signing off and wishing you kia kaha for the climate.